This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today, we're going to talk about something that, might be going with the season. Spring is upon us after a long, hard winter, and maybe it's time to take a walk. And we're going to talk about an epic walk that's possible from the East Coast to the center of North Dakota on the North Country Trail. We have with us today Bob Stein. He's with the Dakota Prairie chapter of the North Country Trail. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Doug.
We'll talk about a hiking expo coming up pretty soon here to get people interested in, walking the trail. But let's get some basics first. What is the North Country Trail?
Well, the North Country Trail is one of the hiking trails in the National Scenic Trail System. There's about 10 trails, and the Appalachian Trail and the Northern Crest Trail are some of the more well-known ones. But it's a 4,600-mile trail that runs from Lake Sakakawea State Park in North Dakota, right near Pick City, all the way to Vermont.
Wow.
It goes through 8 states, and it covers 4,600 miles. We have 427 miles in North Dakota.
So the National Park Service has something to do with this?
Right. We act under the auspices of the National Park Service. They declare this a part of that National Scenic Trail System, and they provide grant money for certain things. But the trail itself is largely built and maintained by volunteers, and that's what the Dakota Prairie chapter of the North Country Trail Association does.
Well, that does sound daunting, 4,600 miles of trail maintained by volunteers. So give us a sense of what you have to do in North Dakota.
Okay. As I said, 427 miles in North Dakota, and the Dakota Prairie chapter has responsibility for nearly 100 miles of trail. Our segment of trail begins right at the Minnesota border at Fort Abercrombie, and it runs westward through Colfax and then Walcott and then over to the National Grasslands and then Lisbon and through Lisbon to the Cheyenne State Forest. All told, that's, as I said, nearly 100 miles of trail.
How's the trail marked?
We have blue blazes that are put on posts and trees and sprayed on rocks, wherever there's a surface that we can mark to let people know that they are actually on the trail. We mark it with what we call a blue blaze.
Yes, I can see that. That might be on a tree or something. And there might even be an icon on a post telling you it's a North Country Trail as well. That said, it's a trail. And so how do you find it?
Well, there's a couple different ways you can find it. Northcountrytrail.org will get you to the national organization's website. And then for local activities, we have them on the North Country Trail website and also on the local meetup. We have a North Country Trail site there.
How many members belong to the Dakota Prairie chapter?
We have approximately 90 memberships, but some of them are couples and families and so forth. So we have about 140 individual members right now in our chapter.
So are you coming up on the busy season here or the trail maintenance season?
Absolutely. We have an aggressive plan for the coming season. First of all, we have to maintain what we have. We have to go out and mow that, and the pocket gophers seem to like the areas where we have trail in a lot of places. So we got to rake down those mounds so they don't give the trail a roller coaster type effect. And if there's tree branches, we have to cut them, or roots that we might be tripping on, we need to do that. And then we'll also be building some new trail in some certain places.
Well, what kinds of places are you talking about?
Typically what happens is when you declare a trail, the National Park Service will give you a route. And if there's places where they can use public lands, such as we have, the National Grasslands, we can plan on going through them. Otherwise, we have mostly privately owned land. In North Dakota, I think I heard that there's 4% public land. So the rest of it, we need to get agreements with the property owners to go across their property with our trail. So we have to talk with them and figure out some right-of-way agreements or easements or any kind of an agreement that says they're okay with us walking across their land.
And is that typically a long process?
It can be, or it can be real simple. Uh-huh. It's something that just depends on where you're at and who you're talking to and how things are going that day to a high degree.
Okay. Well, in the days of the Oregon Trail, and the NOAA Trail was a way to get from point A to point B. I assume that the North Country Trail has a somewhat different mission in that the walk is sort of the benefit, and the sites along the way add to that benefit.
That's exactly right, Doug. The trail itself takes you through some beautiful country. Over the past 3 years, I've had an opportunity to walk a couple hundred miles of the trail in North Dakota, and you get a really unique view of our state when you view it from a trail, and you're on foot. You get an appreciation for a lot of things that you might zoom past in a car and not even see sometimes. And after walking a lot of miles on that trail in North Dakota, I have to say that our public land part of it, the Cheyenne Grasslands, is just a gem out there, in just a wonderful, wonderful area to walk through. And the terrain is different than we have down here in the bottom of the valley. And there's different wildlife, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful area to see.
Is the Dakota Prairie Chapter largely a volunteer organization to do, you know, maintenance of the trail, or is it a fundraising organization?
It is a maintenance organization. Our funds come from memberships. We have memberships. You can belong to the national organization, but most of the members affiliate with a local chapter, and a portion of those dues then come back to the local chapter. Also, there's grants that we've been able to get through the National Park Service and through the state of North Dakota. We've had a little success also. So that's how we're funded. I don't think we've ever had a fundraiser for this organization just to go out and have a raffle or something.
What are the dues?
Well, it's a voluntary type thing. We used to have dues set, but right now for a $20 donation, you will get the satisfaction of knowing you're part of something bigger than you are, and that's not going to be done for a long time, and something you can enjoy. But you'll also get a digital copy of The Blue Blaze, which is the national publication. For $40, you get that plus the hard copy. And then anything over and above that you would choose to give would go just for general work on the trail and maintenance, acquiring right-of-ways, just the workaday stuff that has to be done.
And you've got this expo coming up on Monday from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Wanzek Center for Scouting in South Fargo. Talk about what this third annual Fargo Hiking Expo will be all about.
Okay, the expo is on Monday, April 22nd, which is coincidentally Earth Day. We really didn't plan it that way, but when we saw that that was where we were going, we said, well, that's fortuitous for us. So, yeah, it's on Monday, April 22nd from 6:30 to 8:30. What we want to do is we want to just inspire people to think about using the trail and to get outdoors and enjoy what we have to offer. The expo itself will feature a couple things. We have some booths that we set up, and some of them will show camping and hiking equipment like backpack tents, sleeping bags that you can carry with you, gear for cooking if you're going to be doing backpacking. Where do you want to hike? There will be one booth that will have maps and people at that booth who are familiar with all the hiking opportunities in the area, not just the North Country Trail. We also have some cooperation this year and some good help from Shields, who is going to have a booth set up with some of their hiking clothing. The technology in hiking clothing has advanced a lot over the past 20 years or so, certainly. And then also the Merrell Footwear Company is going to be here. They're one of the leaders in footwear, which is, you would think, rather mundane, but footwear has changed along with uses. Hiking trails used to be things that people would go on who were in it for the long term, the backpacking and so forth. But now we've got things like fast hikers, you know, and trail runners. Well, they take a totally different kind of boot than if you're carrying a 50-pound pack. So the footwear component of it is probably a little broader than you might think.
The third annual Fargo Hiking Expo is Monday, the 22nd of April, at the Wanzek Center for Scouting in South Fargo. And at 7:30, your featured speaker is somebody with an interesting message, Caitlin Thompson. We've been talking about these trails. Sometimes people kind of despoil the trail by leaving something there they shouldn't.
Yeah, we were fortunate to get Caitlin to join us at our expo. She has a history of taking long walks, and she has hiked the entire Appalachian Trail, which is about 2,100 miles. And while she was on that hike, it just came to her that there was a lot of trash on the trail that shouldn't be there. So she took it upon herself to start picking up trash, whatever kind it was, and carrying it to a point where she could deposit it in a proper receptacle. And during the course of her hike, she carried out well over 300 pounds of trash from on the trail. And this has become a trademark of her outings. She has also thru-hiked the Superior Hiking Trail, which I think now is close to 300 miles in length, that runs from south of Duluth up to the Canadian border.
Wow.
It's also, the Superior Hiking Trail is also a part of the North Country Trail. It was the points of least resistance, so as they were planning routes, they saw that trying to go straight east and west from Superior, Wisconsin, and Duluth, there was nothing but swamp.
And yes, there was a fellow who famously tried to build a road, a corduroy road, from western Minnesota to Duluth, and never made it.
Right. So anyway, that the Superior Trail, she's a Minnesota person. I think she grew up around Elk River, and I've never met her personally. I've talked to her on the phone a couple of times, and I'm looking forward to her talk, and that's, again, going to be at about 7:30 is when she will be giving her talk on the 22nd.
And she's going to be volunteering on the North Country Trail as well. Obviously, she has through the parts in Minnesota. Let's talk about this thing, though, that she kind of represents, which is leave no trace.
Well, you know, that's a term I started hearing when I started backpacking back in the early 90s. And it was around for a while before that, but it really wasn't an old term. But what the idea is, you know, attitudes have really changed over the past 30, 40 years about littering and not spoiling places that you go to, particularly wild places. The idea of the leave no trace, which has pretty much become gospel for backpackers and hikers, is there should be no trace of you after you leave, except for maybe grass that might be packed down a little bit if you set up a tent. But other than that, there's no trace of you having been there. That's what we strive for when we're in the wild.
You mentioned you'd hiked about 200 miles of the trail that's in North Dakota, and there's 4,600 miles of the North Country Trail.
Mm-hmm.
Have you hiked any of the other trails in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. I've hiked the Superior Hiking Trail. I've hiked that entire trail several years ago now. At the time I hiked it was about not quite 200 miles long.
Do you typically run into people on the trail?
It depends where you're hiking. On the North Country Trail in North Dakota, not so much.
Uh-huh.
On the Superior Hiking Trail during the fall of the year, it's very common to run into people. I've hiked on short stretches of the Appalachian Trail, and you run into people there pretty easily. I've hiked the North Country Trail in Wisconsin also, in the Brule River area, and it was fall of the year. We ran into a couple people, but not much traffic at all.
What's the vision for the future of these trails? I mean, more trail building, more promotion of the use of the trails?
In the long term, we would like to see the trails all be moved off-road. As I said, when trails are originally planned, the routes usually take the points of least resistance, and if there are points that there is resistance or there's just not an apparent way for the route, it's designated to be an on-road hike. And in the state of North Dakota, for example, we have about 55% of the North Country Trail is off-road. The rest of it is still on-road. So the goal, the most immediate goal in regards to the route, is to try and get the trail all off-road. It's a better hiking experience. It's safer. It's easier. It's easier on the body if you're walking on something other than a hard road surface. So that, I would say, is the goal right now. And it is a rather long-term goal. I mean, because getting to that point, as I said, you have to get agreement from property owners. You have to find an appropriate route. You have to get the people to go out and do the work. So there's a lot of organizing that has to come before you actually get out and do the trail building.
Do you ever see that landowners kind of get involved with maintaining the trail too?
Yes. Yeah, we have some landowners who embrace the trail. I mean, they see the value in it and they enjoy it. And they can I remember when I was hiking on the Superior Hiking Trail, there was a spot where there was a sign from one of the neighbors who said, you know, they had a little spur trail going down into their farmyard. And it said, if you have time, come down here and you can have some goat's milk, which was very, very nice and just a friendly gesture. And we try and get along with our neighbors out there. We realize that a trail like the North Country Trail in North Dakota is going to go through private property. It's going to go through the grasslands where we share use out there with the ranchers who have the grazing contracts and so forth. And we feel that we can coexist with just about anybody.
All right. Well, Bob Stein is with the Dakota Prairie Chapter of the North Country Trail. Once again, this third annual Fargo Hiking Expo is coming up on Monday, the 22nd of April, from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Wonsick Center for Scouting in South Fargo. There'll be exhibits of gear and explanations of, you know, the ways to become an effective hiker, and you'll meet Caitlin Thompson. That all that stuff's going on, and you can find out more about the North Country Trail and other aspects of this project from northcountrytrail.org. And you'll find the Dakota Prairie chapters up there along with the other chapters that are associated with this 4,600-mile walking trail across the northern tier of the United States. Thanks for being with us, Bob.
You're welcome.
Coming up next, a different sort of trail. WishFest has a run-walk event to raise money for Make-A-Wish.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
Greetings, friends. I am Theodore Roosevelt. I have been gone 100 years, but I think it's just bully that I will be able to pop in once a week on this grand Dakota Datebook series to share some of my thoughts. As you know, I have a special place in my heart for North Dakota, and I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you again. In all modesty, I had a great deal to say on many topics, and I earnestly hope you will find some value in my insights and ideas. So join me once a week on Dakota Datebook and sign up for the, what do you call it? Oh, yes, podcast.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Nick Schulich. He is a coordinator for Make-A-Wish North Dakota. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Give us a little background on your connection with Make-A-Wish North Dakota.
So I started out a class project in college. We had to do a presentation on what kind of fundraiser we wanted to do for any nonprofit organization that we could think of. And 6 years ago, I started this event called WishFest, and it benefits Make-A-Wish North Dakota. The main reason why it benefits Make-A-Wish North Dakota is because during the time of this class project, there was all over the news that Miles Scott, the Bat Kid.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was in San Francisco, and Make-A-Wish turned the whole city of San Francisco to Gotham City for him.
Yes, I remember that.
So he got to drive around in his Lamborghini Batmobile, and he got to battle all the classic villains and save a damsel in distress and just have a great time in general.
It's a touching story, and it's about the mission of Make-A-Wish is to provide, frankly, satisfy some pretty remarkable wishes of people who are young kids, especially who are dealing with life-threatening conditions.
Yeah, and it just really – it doesn't only help just the Make-A-Wish kids. I think it really does help the community bring them together, and they certainly did in San Francisco. Oh, he was being cheered on by hundreds of thousands of people. And that really inspired me to do this event, to give my presentation instead of just benefiting one kid. I wanted to make sure like our whole community of kids were feeling like superheroes and they could carry on these memories with them down the road so they could be better for their own community as well.
Well, it's coming up in North Dakota. There will be Wish Fest coming up on Saturday, May 4th. It will take place in Fargo, Bismarck, and Williston.
Yeah.
What happens at a Wish Fest event?
Well, at Wish Fest, you come in, you sign up. You can do a walk-in registration or pre-register on our Facebook page. There are links all over the place there. And you can sign up there and make sure you're wearing your costume and you got dressed for the occasion.
Uh-huh.
And when you come to it, we have a 3, 5, and 10K event. The 10K is exclusive to Fargo. The 3 and 5K are in both Minot and Williston. And during this run, you'll have all sorts of obstacle courses to go through for the kids. They'll get to go through a kryptonite minefield, Captain America's shield throwing toss, Thor's hammer tossing kind of events. And along the way, they get to battle villains while they're on the course. So we don't try to make this just a long, boring run. We want to make it more of an adventure so everyone's having fun. We want to see all these runners come back and have a good time again.
So this is a fundraiser for Make-A-Wish?
It is, yep. We donate since 6 years ago at the first event. We've been donating the money to Make-A-Wish, and we raised almost $50,000.
Wow. So are there kids there taking part or that might have some wishes brewing, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we try to make sure Make-A-Wish has their kids involved in the event. We try to make sure all the obstacle courses are suitable for them if they are in a wheelchair or they can go through any sort of obstacle that they need to.
So what does it take to coordinate something like this, getting the cities online? And frankly, I mean, people have to run these events.
Yeah, and it's really just a hobby that we put together, and it's just become such a passion of ours that I have friends that follow me the whole way throughout the whole year and have been doing it since year one. And we meet each other, just get together, and it seems like the first conversation we bring up right away is Wish Fest and talking about how to make it better, how to make it more fun, and how we would want to do it as kids and have relive our glory days.
Well, if somebody wants to experience the Wish Fest event in Fargo, where would they go on the 4th of May?
Well, in Fargo, we're doing it at Urban Plains Park, which is right next to Shields Arena. And during the event, you'll see our shelter where you can walk in and sign up or just pre-register and let us know you're there. We'll be selling shirts at this stand, and we'll also be giving away a bunch of big prizes at the end of all the runs.
What about the other venues, Williston and Minot and Bismarck?
Yeah, Bismarck is going to be in Sertoma Park, and Williston will be in Spring Lake Park.
What time of day?
Well, the event goes from 8 to 11. For all the events we have scheduled on our Facebook page, you can see the full lineup per event on each of the individual Facebook events that are for Bismarck and Williston and Fargo.
Is this Wish Fest? How do you find it on Facebook?
Yep. You search Wish Fest and it should pop right up. This year's theme is more of a Star Wars theme because May the 4th be with you.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So we'll have some superheroes, some Jedis, some Darth Vaders all across the state, and that's what I really love about this event. It's a whole state of superheroes coming together for one cause.
Okay, so it's May 4th in Fargo, Bismarck, and Williston. It's Wish Fest, and you can search out more information on Facebook. And Nick Schulich, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media has a report for us, and Ron Smith will talk about what we can do to get the soil ready for what is going to be the green season. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A report from the State Auditor's Office has found that the State College of Science in Wahpeton has engaged in inappropriate activities surrounding its Career Workforce Academy. The performance audit also found that the academy is not meeting its goals and overstating program results. College President John Richmond has issued a response taking issue with many of the conclusions.
I disagree with many of the recommendations coming forward from the state audit because I know all of our employees are well within compliance of not only State Board of Higher Education policy, but NDSCS policy, as well as North Dakota Century Code.
Richmond says he was not given an opportunity to respond to the audit before it was released. Fargo City Commissioner Tony Grinberg, who works for the school, is married to the chief financial officer of Flint Group, a Fargo advertising and public relations company. The audit found a conflict of interest between Grinberg and his wife was not fully disclosed while the company was paid tens of thousands of dollars to come up with a strategic plan to the College of Science. State Auditor Josh Gallion says the activities uncovered in the audit are concerning, and the report points to several changes that must be made at NDSCS to get back on track. And changes could be coming to the public entrance of the State Capitol building in Bismarck. In 2017, metal detectors were installed at the south entrance. That was during the DAPL protests, but the legislature decided to keep them in place and make the south entrance the only one the public could use.
This was such a long, cold winter. When you walked down that hallway and you went past the front entrance, it was like just a cold blast of air was coming through there continually.
Cooperstown Republican Representative Don Vigasas says the new public entrances would be placed at either end of the tunnel, which was closed to traffic several years ago as a security measure. He says placing the entrances at the ends of the tunnel would help keep things warmer.
And so there'd be entrances from the east and the west into a large lobby that would be very welcoming and warm. And then also we'd look at probably having the security a little more integrated into the building instead of the standalone magnetometers that they have now, which are kind of unsightly, I'd say. And so the security could be integrated into the architecture of the entrance, and I think it would be much more pleasing to the eye and more convenient for the public.
Vigasa says the money would come from existing Capitol building funds. He says the spending authority would be added to the Office of Management and Budget spending bill.
It's the one thing I think we need to do to modernize and beautify our beautiful Capitol complex.
The amendment to the OMB bill is on the House calendar. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk about a nearly forgotten founding father.
Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, the hero of the yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia in 1793, and the man who gave the title to Thomas Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense.
We speak this week with the author, Stephen Fried, whose new book is Rush, Revolution, Madness, and Benjamin Rush, the visionary doctor who became a founding father.
Among other things, Dr. Rush brought Jefferson and John Adams back into correspondence after their friendship had broken apart in the hectic years around 1800, and the exchange of letters that he made happen is regarded by historians as one of the greatest in all of American history.
And Rush seems to pop up everywhere in American revolutionary history.
He was with George Washington at the crossing of the Delaware.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. It's projected this year that the average American meat eater will consume 220 pounds of meat and more than 200 pounds of milk and cheese. Despite that near record demand, farmers are producing all this faster than it sells. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports that the glut, caused in part by trade issues, is creating problems on what to do with all that perishable food.
Companies looking to put something in cold storage, like food, might be out of luck these days. Corey Rosenbusch is the president of the Global Cold Chain Alliance, a trade group representing the industry. He says right now, the facilities he represents are at 86% capacity.
In our space, anywhere from 82 to 90 is considered full.
Rosenbusch says there's a large supply in the U.S. of chicken, beef, pork, cheese, and milk, and it all has to go somewhere.
All of these, you know, really have created a perfect storm of significantly high capacities and really very little space available out there.
There are lots of reasons why there's so much extra meat and dairy out there. Increased efficiency is pushing production higher, on average 2% a year over the past decade. During that same time, demand dropped off during the recession and is just now getting back to 2007 levels. Tariffs are also hurting exports. So the federal government has stepped in to try to distribute the excess.
Hey, have the Jeep go up to the next one. And you can pull up me for this first cone right here.
About 24 food bank volunteers are working to set up a makeshift drive-thru for a special food distribution day in a vacant parking lot in St. Louis. There are 6 pallets, each stacked more than 6 feet high with half-gallon jugs of whole milk, waiting to be put in the trunks of the cars that drive through. Lenora Gooden is in charge of operations for the St. Louis Area Food Bank and says this is an unscheduled distribution.
So it's a blessing to us because it's also milk and the stuff that can go bad quickly that we don't have to purchase because we don't get it donated so much in these quantities. So we'll take whatever they send us. We just get a little more creative in how we distribute it.
This extra food comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. As part of the effort to help farmers hurt by tariffs, the USDA is buying 250 million pounds of meat and 65 million pounds of cheese and milk to distribute to food banks across the country. In St. Louis today, it's just dairy. The meat should arrive next month. With cold storage at capacity and food banks inundated, something's got to give. Scott Brown is an agricultural economist with the University of Missouri. He says production has been outpacing demand for long enough that he sees a breaking point.
It is sending the signal to the supply side of these industries to at least slow the growth that we've seen for the last few years. So as I look ahead in 2019 and in 2020 in particular, it seems like we're going to find a little better balance.
But meat and dairy producers don't see it that way. Economist Bill Roenick works for a number of meat trade groups and says despite the surplus and lower prices, more efficient meat production has many farmers in the black.
Chicken is making money. Certain parts of beef are making money. Certain parts of the pork industry are making money. So in that sense, if you're making money, the signals are you should continue to do what you're doing or produce a bit more.
There has been increased demand for some of the food piling up. China's pigs were hit with an outbreak of African swine fever, so China bought 23,000 tons of U.S. pork despite the tariff. That's meat that would have otherwise gone into cold storage or to overloaded food banks. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks into America's farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation. Introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2019 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2019 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away with Words. The show started back in 1998 at KPBS, and there were two other co-hosts at the time.
And then you joined the show. What year was that? Was that 2004, 2005, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I came along in 2006 for shows to be broadcast in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are. We've done the show together more than 10 years. How about that?
How about that?
People who don't read carefully and don't hear us say our names carefully do think we're married sometimes. Yes, we are not married. My last name is Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, and Martha's last name is Barnett, B-A-R-N-E-T-T-E. It is just a coincidence.
We are virtually married on the radio.
Yeah,
but...
we're radio spouses. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away with Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Ron Smith, our horticulturist, is back because the growing season is upon us, almost.
Yes, almost. It's working very hard to get here and get the snow out of our sight and out of our minds and have us thinking ahead to the wonderful spring that we usually have here in North Dakota once the snow is gone. So we want to talk about what we can do this spring, but not get too anxious to get started on it.
Yeah, well, my hands are like actually, I have to kind of hold them back,
back
from picking out too much stuff because
yeah.
One of the things that makes me a bad gardener is over eagerness, and I just want to get outside as soon as I possibly can tolerate.
You know
the
something, Ashley?
And do it all in one weekend and then not ever do it again. I'm a terrible gardener.
you're not an exception. That's the case with everybody that enjoys gardening. As soon as the snow disappears, they are so pent up to try to get something going.
Mm-hmm.
And we just all overdo it. I've got a wife that I can't talk into waiting to start her tomato plants. So she started them about a month and a half ago, and now they're about that tall.
And that looks like about
that tall, being
tall.
About half the length of my forearm. And
this is radio, Ron.
They're growing beautifully. But now is the time, if you want to have tomatoes and peppers, now's the time to start the seed in your basement or under grow lights or whatever you want to do, however you want to go ahead and start them. But now is the time to do it. These last couple of weeks, in April, and then by the time they're ready to transplant, which will be the end of May or around Memorial Day weekend, is a perfect time to go ahead and put them out. Knock on wood.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the long winter we had, the two blizzards we had almost back-to-back to end the winter, we hope. as the snow is melting away, I am being greeted by a not very pretty lawn.
Well, you know, welcome to the club. They're ugly as can be, rabbit droppings all over the place. If you don't have snow mold, feel discriminated against because every lawn that I've ever looked at around our neighborhood, everybody has snow mold, including us. But it's not anything to be upset about. But you don't want to get out there with an iron rake, your old garden iron rake, and start scratching up the grass yet. If you have to do anything, walk around and pick things up by hand until you can step on the grass and not leave a soggy footprint. And then go and get a leaf rake and very lightly, good upper body, light exercise, rake up after it starts to dry down a little bit. Keep in mind that the crown is the place where the new grass blades grow from. And if you damage them too much, you're going to have a really punky-looking lawn. So wait until it dries a little bit. You can walk on it. You can put your hand on it. It's not doesn't come back soaking wet. And then go ahead and take that light broom rake and rake up everything.
You mentioned snow mold. Is that something that just heals itself? I mean, it just needs to dry out or what? Do you have to be proactive about it?
Yes and no. It's like putting up with a pimple on the end of your nose, okay? It's not going to hurt you, but you don't like looking at it, okay? So you're going to do something to get rid of it, you know, have somebody break it for you if you can't bear to break it yourself, but just get rid of the doggone thing or cover it up. Grass will grow no matter what we do. We're going to have eventually some grass growing in the worst-looking places, but it's not going to be the kind of grass that you're going to be proud of. So if you want to push this along, get out there and lightly rake it after it dries out a little bit. And then where you have bare spots, go to places like Shields Hardware, which is all over our region here, and buy your grass seed in bulk. Don't buy it 5 pounds at a time. Because 5 pounds at a time will treat 5,000 square feet or more. And you're overseeding. You're not putting in a new lawn. You're overseeding. So basically, if you're going to be overseeding, you need maybe about a pound and a half to 2 pounds of bulk grass seed to go out and buy. Keep in mind that Kentucky bluegrass, which is the premier grass in our region all over the upper part of the Midwest here, is a cool season grass. It'll do well now. And all you need to do is just get a little bit down there, but scratch that surface so there's something for that little fine seed. There's 1.5 to 2 million seeds per pound. So get that in there. You don't need to put it on like you're trying to put granola on top of a coffee cake or something like that. If you get it too thick, it's not going to work. You're going to get seedling competition, and you're going to get a very poor establishment taking place. You'll get the nice little green patch, but it's not going to be evenly distributed. Most homeowners, golf course superintendents, of course, and parks managers, of course, like to have a nice uniform-looking lawn. Very, very, very uniform. That's visually very beautiful. But ecologically, it's wrong. And I'm sorry, lawn care operators out there, if you hear this, I'm not against it. I made a living most of my life talking and working with grasses, and I'm going to work on my lawn just as hard as anybody else this year. But it's not ecologically sound, so be prepared.
What do you mean by ecologically it's wrong?
It's a monoculture. And when our pioneers first came over to the country, they didn't have lawns. They just had a yard. They put a home up there, built a home out of the lumber that we had here, the timber that we had. And then somebody got the idea, well, you know, in Europe we had some very nice, majestic-looking turf. So let's go ahead and do the same thing. So you have this little patch, you get some seed and you get it planted and looks pretty good. Well, that's a sign of aristocracy. You know, you're somebody above the common folk if you have a lawn. And so this eventually grew and grew and grew to the enormously huge industry that we have today. I mean, universities are doing research. They're competing for research money. Professors are getting tenure or not getting tenure based on their research on turf grass. Seed companies are doing everything they can to convince you, the owner, that this is the best grass seed you can buy. If you buy their brand name, and I'm not going to start mentioning any brand names because I'll probably get in trouble if I do, but they all have good grass seed. The best thing for the consumer to do is to take a look at the date that was tested. Okay, if you don't have any dates where you go to buy your grass seed, they don't have any dates for testing, then don't buy it. It should be of this past February 2019, not 2018. It should be tested for germination and purity on 2019 February. And that would be the latest date that you'd want to have it tested.
But if ecologically it's not always...
it's not good. So I want to compliment you and thank you for leading me into this, because you're taking your lawn and you're gradually making your lawn into a meadow. That's far more natural than having a monoculture of green grass. Even though we like it visually, your meadow will look fantastic once it gets established and going on a regular basis. And it'll take minimum maintenance, a heck of a lot less maintenance than a lawn grass will.
Yeah, you'll probably notice the rabbits and voles.
Oh, God, yes.
Let's talk about voles for a minute, because I've been hearing a lot about them lately, and I know that they can come and go.
Mm-hmm.
This might be a year where they're coming around a lot.
Well, yes, and they do. There's a high proliferation of voles and rabbits.
Yeah.
We have both running around in our backyard, and we also have seen hawks circling over our property.
The food
well.
Chain right there.
Yes, there you go. So they will eventually dissipate. Voles will dissipate. Cats will get them. Dogs will get them. Birds will get them. Your predatory birds will get them. So they'll eventually dissipate. They're very shy, so they'll get away from your activity. You get out there and you start running this horrible-sounding lawnmower around your lawn or near your flower beds. They're going to get the heck out of there. And when they get the heck out of there, somebody is going to be looking for them. And that opportunistic cat or that hawk or that owl is going to go ahead and get it. So your vole population will go down. It'll go down. But the ugliness that they've created will eventually go away. I promise you. I promise you.
Those trails, those
yes,
mounds.
Those trails, yes. They have all these little looking like the Red River course here. If you've ever flown over the Red River, there's probably not 100 yards of straightness in the whole Red River Valley. It's all twists and turns and curves and everything else. So, yes, they will eventually disappear. As far as rabbits go, the only way we've tried to control rabbits on our property is through live trapping. And a couple years ago, we took as many as 9 rabbits to the north part of the city near the dump. I'm not going to tell you where that was, but we got rid of them. They're far enough away, they aren't going to find their way back to our place. And we've noticed a couple of rabbits, adult rabbits, running and romping around in our yard in our backyard already. You know, sitting there looking at us, eating some of the squirrel and bird food that we have, thanking us very much for it, nodding their head, and go hopping off. So they're very healthy. So if the hawk gets them, he's going to get some very, very well-nourished rabbit meat. Bingo.
It's a cycle. What about tree care this time of year?
Tree care, minimally, if you see anything that's broken or damaged, consider taking it out. If you can do it with both feet on the ground and using good pruning shears. If you have to reach or take a ladder out, I advise not doing it, even somebody your age, because you can fall from climbing in a tree, and that could ruin your life. You would become crippled or, in a great deal of pain for a long time. So try to hire somebody that knows what they're doing. Certified arborists are all over the place here. So go online, look for certified arborists. There's several of them in our Fargo-Moorhead area and certainly all across the state, in Bismarck and Grand Forks and Minot. In the major cities around the state, there are certified arborists. Look them up. Talk to them. Ask them for a reference. Mm. Okay? Ask them for a reference or two. And so, I pruned so-and-so's big ash over there, that huge ash, and he or she was very happy with it. That's what you want to hear, somebody that's been satisfied with the work. Don't buy tree pruning from the cheapest offer that you get. If they aren't certified, they're going to be cheaper. If they are certified, they're going to be a little bit more expensive. But most certified arborists have insurance close to $1 million of liability. So if anything goes wrong, and they hate paying insurance, and if they have anything going wrong and claim against their insurance company, bingo, the premiums go up. So they're going to be very, very, very careful.
How about perennial plants and shrubs? Is this what should we be doing about them this time of year?
Well, if they need to be cut back, like we have several perennials on our property, and, of course, what's perennial is now sticking up above the snow.
Hydrangeas are sticking up there.
Yeah. So go ahead and clean them up, trim them up a little bit. You're going to get the growth from the crown anyway, the hydrangeas especially. Delphiniums, the old dead spikes that you had your delphiniums on, for example, they're dead. They're dead as doornails, but there's growth there in that crown that's going to go ahead and sprout and grow. Mm-hmm. And the dead part of it will eventually subside, just deteriorate. So you don't have to worry about that. The most critical time, if you planted perennials last fall, these have not developed an extensive root system yet. So if we have freeze-thaw problems, which is typically what's going to happen on the south exposure of your property, open exposure, you're going to see some of these maybe not making it when it's supposed to be making it or surviving here in zone 3 or zone 4. Mm. So you might want to give them a little bit of protection. Once it starts to dry out, go ahead and put some straw around there to keep this freeze-thaw from making such an impact on lifting the root system out and resulting in its death. So we can still have cold snaps. We hope we don't have any more snow, but we can still have cold snaps.
Well, I am wondering about those cold snaps. Obviously, with the really horrendously cold temperatures that we had over this winter, that's good for mm-hmm. things like killing a lot of bugs and keeping some of those at bay. But a slow spring can be good for things like maple sugaring.
Mm-hmm.
What else is a slow spring good for? Is this, are we good?
Well, a slow spring
is patience.
It helps us develop patience. It's
self-improvement.
It's tough to be patient when you want something, you know.
I know. Right. But is it the kind of thing where if spring is slow, let's make
a comparison, actually. Okay. Here's a fast spring on the left and a slow spring on the right. What's the big difference? A fast spring means tomorrow we're going to have 80 degrees, and we're going to have 80 degrees and no rain whatsoever, and the temperature at night is going to stay above freezing. It's going to get down into the 40s, and we're going to have 75 to 80 degrees for the next week or so. We say, that's wonderful. That's fantastic. But if that continues, you're going to have things breaking, bursting, opening mm-hmm. up, growing like weeds. Okay, they're going to be growing topsy. And then we get that little bit of a cold snap that we can get even in July. I remember a couple of July, 4th of July, I was freezing to death watching the fireworks. Mm. How can it be this cold on the 4th of July? It's because we're in North Dakota. That's why we're up here in the north part of the country, and it has a right to get cold when it wants to. So in spite of our wishes, desires, and wants, nature's going to do what she wants to do in spite of what we want. So that's the big difference between a fast spring and a slow spring. A slow spring, things are not going to get dehardened too fast.
Okay.
They're going to retain a little bit of hardiness. So if we do get a cold snap, that hurt, but it didn't kill me. And so that's a big difference.
So the slow spring is actually
good.
Better thing, yes.
All right. If you have a question for horticulturist Ron Smith, it's easy to ask.
You can send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, or you can find us on Facebook. We are Main Street at Prairie Public.
Always a pleasure to have you with us, Ron.
Likewise. It's great to be here.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with Jerry Doan. He's with the North Dakota Grazing Lands Coalition. He'll talk about all the factors that go into grazing lands and ranching, and we'll have a musical performance from Melissa Curren. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 16th. Yesterday, we brought you part one of the story of Carl Ben Eielson, the first man to fly over the top of the world. We left him and his partner, George Wilkins, after they crash-landed in 1927 on an iceberg during a blizzard. Wilkins, the navigator, estimated they were 65 miles from safety and floating farther away each moment. On the sixth day, cold weather had formed enough ice for them to leave. In her 1947 book, The Flying North, author Jean Potter wrote, They drained what little fuel they could from the tank and improvised an oil burner from a gallon can. They built sleds from airplane parts. Loading them with food and supplies, they left the shelter of their plane and set out across the frozen sea. The men's journey was horrific. Potter described them as sinking to their waists in snowdrifts and crawling on all fours across broken pressure ridges. After 13 days, they reached the Beachy Point fur trading post. The following year, on this date, they tried again. Their new orange Lockheed Vega was the second ever built. Their 3,500-pound load was mostly fuel, their food mostly chocolate. Their airstrip was glare ice, 14 feet wide, but they took off successfully. The first 20 hours and 20 minutes passed uneventfully, covering about 2,100 miles. Then, when they were almost to the Norwegian coastline, a severe storm came up. All they could see were two mountains ahead of them. The windshield was covered with snow and frozen oil. Forced to land, they came down on Dead Man's Island. The storm trapped them for 5 days. The snow got so deep, the terrain was so rough that they couldn't lift off. Wilkins got out and pushed and was supposed to jump on as soon as the plane took off. But unknown to Eielson, Wilkins had fallen. Luckily, Eielson circled, spotted him on the ground, and landed. Their second try failed too. Finally, Wilkins used a piece of driftwood to push from the cabin door, and they were airborne. Within minutes, they spotted the radio towers of Green Harbor, their final destination. They had done the impossible. For his air-breaking feat, Eielson was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross and the Harmon Trophy, and Wilkins, a British subject, was knighted by King George V. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Wednesday on Main Street, Chronicles of a Radical Hag with Recipes is a novel from author and comedian Lorna Landvik. It's a story about journalism, cooking, and small-town life in North Dakota and Minnesota. And Bill Sorensen is about to begin his final season co-hosting the Medora musical. On Wednesday, he joins us to reflect upon his time on stage and to preview this upcoming season. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.